This is In Conversation from Apple News. I'm Shamita Basu. Today, America's big, polarizing student debt problem. About two decades ago, Ryan Liebenthal graduated from Reed College in Portland, Oregon.
This was 2005, and I had something like $21,000 of debt.
A few years after graduating, Ryan decided that she wanted more out of her life and career, so she applied for a graduate journalism program at New York University. It was expensive, but
they offered me a one-semester tuition scholarship, and they encouraged me to take out loans.
She got her master's degree in 2010 and left NYU with more than $100,000 of debt. Her first job as a fact checker paid about $31,000 a year.
I was like terribly depressed about it. And I would just be like, this is just, it's just a black hole. I will never get out of this. I will never have a house. I will never be able to have children. I felt worthless.
Today, 45 million Americans, or about one in six adults, owe $1.7 trillion in student loan debt. That's millions of people carrying around the kinds of fears and anxieties Ryan did for so long. So she decided to write about it. Her book is called Burdened: Student Debt and the Making of an American Crisis. I sat down with Ryan to talk about the student loan system today, how we got here, and some ways to reform it. She started by taking me back to the beginning, to the very first federal student loan program that came about in a kind of surprising way.
The first federal loan program, it's responding to a kind of panic over the launching of Sputnik by the USSR and this idea that we're really far behind on our science and engineering capabilities, and that that's not only embarrassing on the international stage, but is actually dangerous because now the Soviets can launch, you know, missiles and we can't. And that started this push to improve our educational system.
It's almost like a Cold War crisis on the education level.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
We are being out-educated in other parts of the world.
Yeah, and that's exactly how people talked about it, too. Mm. Like, they would refer to the archetypal Ivan in St. Petersburg and how he was getting 4 years of sciences and so vastly better educated, supposedly, than an American who was taking all kinds of electives and, you know, not even getting any science at all, maybe, by the time he graduated high school. And so, in the end, this federal loan program passed. An act was called the National Defense Education Act. It was very small, and it was really targeted toward developing people who would become engineers, who majored in science and math and foreign languages. And in 1965, LBJ ends up creating a bill called the Higher Education Act, and it creates another loan program that becomes the Guaranteed Loan.
Mm-hmm. And how does the Guaranteed Loan program work?
The program worked by having commercial banks loan out the money, and the federal government would basically guarantee that that money would be paid back. So if a student stopped paying, the government would ultimately, first they would try to track down the student and make them pay. And if that didn't work, they would make the bank basically whole. And that was supposed to be cheaper because on the federal budget, you don't actually have the cost of each loan because it's a commercial bank making the loan. You only have the cost of whatever subsidy you're paying the bank and any eventual payment to the bank if the student defaults. Mm-hmm. But over time, this program becomes really much bigger than it was supposed to be. It was not supposed to involve lower-income students at all. It was supposed to be a stopgap for middle-income parents and students who, you know, sort of made too much money to qualify for certain low-income supports, but could not afford this kind of skyrocketing cost of education. That was a problem even then. Mm. And so this was supposed to fill that gap. But within, you know, half a decade, there were already indicators that lower income students were not only using the loan program, but using it in pretty high rates. And that was already creating this kind of dilemma that lower-income students were becoming indebted beyond what they could handle.
As the decades passed, this problem got bigger. Then, in the early 2000s, as the country approached what came to be known as the Great Recession, the commercial banks that were giving out these student loans started to fail.
The people in the Department of Education were kind of in panic mode, because if you take away student loans, if commercial banks can no longer make student loans, you effectively can't have higher education. We had become so reliant, and essentially every institution had become so reliant on this federal loan money as a kind of backward subsidy to the institutions that they would not be able to function, or at least that was the worry.
So the U.S. Treasury bought up billions of dollars of loans from banks in order to allow them to keep making loans. When President Barack Obama took office, he made a major change to the system. Banks would no longer provide the loans for students. The government would.
And so that's how we get to where we are now, where most people borrow directly from the government.
At the time, this was pitched as a cost-saving measure.
I think what happened basically is that the banks found a way to make it profitable, and then that became the mode by which the government could take it back over, was you had to convince people it was going to be this profit-generating source.
But that's not what happened. A 2024 report by the Government Accountability Office estimated that the direct loan program will cost the federal government nearly $200 billion.
In kind of a parallel to the LBJ guaranteed loan program, which is supposed to be inexpensive because it's the banks who are making the loans, but ends up being a lot more expensive because you have to subsidize the banks, the direct loan program, which is supposed to be inexpensive because you don't have to subsidize the banks and you make this profit, actually so many people end up not being able to pay their loans that you lose all this money and it's not recoverable. Something like a third or more of the student loan portfolio is not really anticipated to be paid back ever. So when we talk about forgiving debt, in some ways it's forgiving debt that is never going to be repaid. So you know, if you don't forgive it or you don't cancel it, which is the term I prefer, you're just going to spend a lot of money trying to collect it and drive someone into penury, you know, just going to push them all the way down, garnish their wages, their Social Security for effectively the rest of their life. And that creates a really toxic relationship, I think, between the lender, the government, and the student, because now they are just a source of profit. So it kind of becomes a question of what are the priorities of this program? You know, what are you actually trying to do with it? Are you trying to make money for the government? Are you trying to help people get a college education? Because those become potentially at odds.
I want to talk a bit about for-profit colleges. They've been around since the very beginning of the system. They can receive federal student loan funds. But these are schools where the primary goal is to generate profit for their owners and their shareholders, as opposed to nonprofit colleges, which is what I think most people think about when they hear the word college. So how do for-profit colleges fit into this picture?
So by the time you get to sort of the modern era, a for-profit school, let's say, will charge a certain amount for its programs, and a lot of the people who go there rely on federal funding for the most part, or maybe entirely. And in large part, the for-profit schools set their tuition at the level of available federal aid. So this is a charge that has been made against higher education as a whole, that schools raise their rates to match the level of federal aid. And the evidence is fairly mixed on whether public schools or nonprofit private schools do this, but it's very clear that for-profit schools do that. You can look at their revenues, and they're allowed to make up to 90% of their revenue from federal sources, and they will go right up to that line. And so they're really just rent-seeking entities, basically, and a lot of them do not provide very much value to their students. So people who go into their programs very often don't finish them. If they do finish them, they don't become employed in a way that benefits them any more than if they hadn't gone to the school. And in fact, there was some study that showed that people who put the for-profit school on their resume, they actually got fewer callbacks than if they put no school at all. So there's a lot of people who are being kind of misled about what they're getting out of these schools, and then they wind up with really high levels of debt, way, way above what they would have, if anything, if they went to a community college.
Can you maybe give an example of a for-profit school and what we've learned about how they function?
Yeah, so I think the example that is sort of most top of mind for me is Corinthian colleges, because I ended up writing about some of the students who went there and who organized against it. Corinthian colleges was one of the biggest chains and was found to have defrauded people. One student talked about how the teachers were always being replaced, and in some cases, the professor would have been a student from the previous term, and that they would be, you know, like playing games during class, not actually learning anything, that it was all kind of just going through the motions of a supposed education. And that this is someone named Nathan Horns. He talked about having been signed up for loans without realizing it. And that's something that I heard a lot and is verified. It's not just something people say, that they're filling out their financial aid forms with the person at the college and being told, oh, you'll get all these grants. These are just grants. You don't have to worry about it. And then only later, you know, they get a bill and they're like, well, why do I have a bill? And they were never told that they were given loans. In some cases, they didn't actually even sign the forms. The school did that for them. The schools would recruit people. You probably saw a lot of the TV advertisements if you ever were home in the middle of the day and watching the Tyra Banks show or whatever. You could see these Everest, Apollo, whatever, that, you know, they always have some kind of elite sounding name.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Lots of ads. I remember TV ads. I've seen web ads for these kinds of schools.
Yeah. And if you would call them up, they would make a pitch. Very strong pitch, trying to play on your hopes and your fears, make you feel like you really owed it to yourself to get an education and try to seal the deal right away. And maybe even over the phone, or they'd have you come in to visit the school, try to get you to sign the paperwork on the spot. They would say, you know, if you don't get in now, you're going to miss the term. The enrollment is too high. We're not going to be able to let you in. That was never true. It was always rolling enrollment. They would do things that made it so you couldn't get refunded on your student aid if you dropped out of the class. It was really just a way of making money off people without really caring about them as people.
Yeah. The Biden administration has canceled almost $175 billion in student debt for more than 4 million borrowers. Does it feel like progress to you?
It doesn't feel like enough progress to me. I do think that they have really benefited a lot of people in very real, measurable ways, which is great. So they functionally fixed the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. They made a lot of people eligible for forgiveness for payments that hadn't been counted because they were made under the wrong repayment plan or whatever, things that people couldn't really have known they were doing wrong.
Kind of making up for bad bookkeeping.
Bad bookkeeping, yeah, bad servicing. I think that was absolutely the right thing to do, necessary. They also have forgiven a lot of the debts of people who were swindled by for-profit schools. That's also really wonderful and necessary. But I think, again, these are sort of piecemeal fixes in a lot of ways. I think for the people who receive those loan cancellations is absolutely life-changing. And, you know, people talk about like bursting into tears when they see their zero balance. But it's obviously not systemic. You know, you can't forgive loans and then just keep making more loans. It doesn't really add up.
Right.
And the incoming administration will not continue those practices. So it didn't particularly solve the ongoing problem.
Well, what do we know about what the Trump administration might do on this issue?
I think if the incoming administration does actually adhere to the plan laid out in Project 2025, which I think they've denied wanting to do, but have shown every indication that they do want to do, then the situation will likely get worse for a lot of people. I don't necessarily think they'll be able to close the Department of Education as Project 2025 lays out.
Which the DOE, of course, administers a student loan program, as we've talked
right.
about.
Right, yeah. Project 2025 wants to eliminate all forgiveness programs, including those enacted by Congress, like PSLF, the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. They're obviously not in support of the Biden-era forgiveness efforts. They're not in support of helping people who have been defrauded by for-profit colleges who are eligible for loan cancellation. So it's hard to say, you know, where there's room for optimism. And it's probably just going to get more expensive. I mean, it's not like costs are going to go down. So I think the situation will ultimately reach a level that it can't be managed anymore, and it will become its own crisis that will have to be fixed to the degree that it's not already. And hopefully there will be enough momentum at that point to actually make a change.
But the way things look today, we are very far from that point. Forgiving student debt has become a political lightning rod, with many Republicans arguing it's both bad fiscal policy and fundamentally unfair.
There's a representative, Virginia Fox, who talked a lot about this when she was chair of the Education Committee.
Here's a reality check for our colleagues across the aisle. There's no such thing as forgiveness. This entire scheme is nothing more than a transfer of wealth from those who willingly took on debt to those who did not or had the grit to pay off their loans.
There's a lot of talk about the taxpayer. What is the cost to the taxpayer of these programs and of any eventual forgiveness?
Our colleagues on the other side of the aisle also claim that this transfer of wealth is about fairness. No, it's about sticking hardworking taxpayers with the tab and those who owe it walking away from it scot-free.
This argument that canceling debt is unfair to taxpayers came up when President Biden tried to cancel up to $400 billion in student loans in 2022. His proposal would have affected tens of millions of borrowers, but it went to the Supreme Court, and in a 6-3 decision, the court ruled that the Biden administration had overstepped its authority with the program.
So I went to the oral arguments, and there was a lot of talk by the conservative justices in that hearing about, you know, the taxpayer or the metaphorical, you know, there's this example of like a lawn guy.
You have two situations, both two kids come out of high school, they can't afford college, one takes a loan, and the other says, well, I'm going to, you know, try my hand at setting up a lawn care service. And he takes out a bank loan for that.
And so what about that guy? Like, if you forgive the debts of other people, you're effectively punishing this guy who was really responsible and didn't go to college because he didn't have the money. And now he, the taxpayer, is having to subsidize these irresponsible people's education debt.
Nobody's telling the person who is trying to set up the lawn service business that he doesn't have to pay his loan. He still does, even though his tax dollars are going to support the forgiveness of the loan. For the college graduate who's now going to make a lot more than him over the course of his lifetime.
There's a lot of issues with that. The one that always gets me the most is that student borrowers are also taxpayers. You know, it's like just because I have debt or if anybody has debt doesn't mean that I'm not also paying taxes. And the other thing is that student debt, in a way, because of how terribly the system works and how much more you end up having to pay than you took out, it becomes a huge tax on the people who end up paying it. Hmm. So if, for instance, you took out $20,000 and you end up having to pay $100,000 back, where is that money going, you know?
Well, where is that money going?
Well, at this point, it's going to the federal government. You know, what they do with it, I don't exactly know. But I think it goes to the budget. It goes to creating money for, you know, other programs. And so that is effectively a tax.
Right.
And I think it's important to remember that.
I want to talk about some of the solutions that you talk about in the book that you see to this growing crisis of people finding themselves in so much debt. What are some of the ideas and the possible solutions that you see that could work here?
we need to completely overhaul the higher education financing system. So we need to move to a system that doesn't require people to get into debt to get a higher education. And what that looks like can take a variety of forms. I spent some time in France, and so I got to see how their educational system works. You know, across Europe, this model is more prevalent, which is that going to college doesn't really cost you anything or very little, you know, kind of nominal fee. And that's because it is paid by the taxpayer. And I think that's a better system than the one we have here. So I think one thing is private nonprofit colleges should be public schools if they're going to take public money. They can choose to become public or choose to not receive the money, you know, and there's a lot of schools that I think would not take the money. There are schools with huge endowments like Harvard, you know, the Ivies, that don't probably need federal money as much as others. And so they would probably remain these elite institutions, and you can criticize that. But I think the more we can create a public system where everyone can enter kind of with the same chance of success, the better we'll be. And then I do think for-profit schools really just shouldn't be allowed to exist, or, you know, allowed to exist, but they should not receive federal public money of any kind. Mm. I'm sure there are good for-profit schools out there, but they're just so riddled with fraud, the industry, that it just shouldn't be allowed to rent seek in the same way that it does. It's just too much of a risk for taking the government and the students for a ride.
Ryan, let's talk for a minute about the GI Bill, because you talk about it in your book, and I know that you're critical of it too, but you bring it up to make a point about education as an investment on a societal level. So the GI Bill, it was passed in June of 1944. It gave a lot of different benefits to veterans returning home from World War II, including up to $500 a year for college tuition, essentially a full scholarship. And you say it was generally seen as a success, right?
Yeah. You know, with the GI Bill, it was like you have a bunch of GIs coming home and they're going to reenter the labor force. And we just came out of a depression. So we really don't want this flood of workers who are all going to be competing for jobs. So let's put them into school, kind of get them out of the way. And that ends up becoming just like a game-changing moment for higher education. People start going to school and thinking they can go to school. And later research found that although it cost a ton of money, it returned that money up to 12-fold in increased taxes because people did make more money. And the people who benefited from the GI Bill were more invested in civic institutions and in their communities. A lot of them became leaders in the civil rights movement. So I do think that education is a public good. I think that it is something that benefits society as a whole. There's a lot of intangible benefits, I think, to having an educated citizenry that we really miss when we focus only on the monetary value.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that idea is investing in higher ed a public good. I mean, that's the real debatable point, right? I think that's the real division point in this country. Do you know where American sentiment lies on that issue today? I mean, any public polling that can tell us?
I kind of personally have found that a lot of people have trouble with that notion. And I think the main part of it is that we have been conditioned over decades and sort of from the beginning to look at education as something that will benefit you monetarily, that it's an investment. So you're viewing yourself as capital, basically, and you're investing in yourself by getting an education. And that pays off in value in your employment. And I think that just creates like a really warped vision of what education is and what it's for. And it's no longer for the kind of idealistic values that I think a lot of people used to think of education as being for, like becoming a more informed citizen, expanding your horizons and your mind and becoming a more whole person, you know? And it becomes just about like, what is the most lucrative field that I can get into? And, you know, right now it's like, oh, become a computer engineer or whatever. Actually, I think that moment might even be past. But that's part of the problem is that it changes. You know, you create a bunch of engineers. Now that's no longer the most lucrative field. Mm,
totally.
And you have to figure out what the next thing is. And so to place that on an individual to try to figure out the sort of like stock market of employment in the world, or, you know, the course of world events that's going to change what is valuable and what isn't, I think it's just asking too much of a single person. And also, you know, it creates this mindset where it is okay to charge people lots of money for this thing because they're supposed to get value out of it. And then also, if they don't get value out of it, it was their fault. They picked the wrong major, they picked the wrong school. And so it just punishes individuals for things that they can't control.
Brian, is there anything, just as a last thought, that you think people often miss when they think about the student loan crisis in America? And what do you want people to be thinking about and really focusing on?
I think a lot of the pushback against relief comes down to arguments about personal responsibility. And I think a lot of that misses the way that people have really been pushed into a system that they don't have a lot of control over, and that asks them to be responsible for things that they really shouldn't have to be. And I think it also diminishes the humanity of the people who are involved in this system, that they're viewed as sort of numbers on a ledger, and that their worth as people, as citizens, comes down to whether they can make a payment that, in my view, they shouldn't ever have been asked to make in the first place. And so I think moving away from this personal responsibility mode and toward one in which we are kind of viewing education as a public good, as a system of mutual benefit for all, would go a long way to correcting that. And I think, too, giving people better visions of themselves and of what society could be.
Brian, thank you so much for your time and for your book.
Yeah, thank you.
You can find Burdened, Student Debt, and the Making of an American Crisis by Ryan Liebenthal on Apple Books. We'll include a link for you on our show notes page.